from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
I was proud to receive the NRA's earliest endorsement in the history of the organization.
So there are new questions emerging about the death of a Texas honor student and standout athlete. He was shot in the head by police on Saturday night. The Balch Springs Police Department now admits that the officer's description of what happened doesn't match the body camera footage.
But I was on the way to winning until the combination of Jim Comey's letter on October 28th and Russian WikiLeaks.
The president wants to see Washington better, get fixed, change the way it does business.
Those are just a few of the sounds of the week. You can join the conversation about the week's news at 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us are two members of the crack staff of the Connecticut Mirror, which you can read at ctmirror.org. First, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Mirror. Hello there, Paz.
Good morning.
And our budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror. Is that your official title, Keith?
You would know because you gave it to me.
The budget guru.
It never gets old, but it could.
Our budget Obi-Wan Kenobi at the Connecticut Mirror, Keith Faniff. Thank you so much, Keith, for joining us. And we are going to start there with the state budget. A little later on in the program, we're going to talk about Chris Murphy and what he's up to in Washington at home and maybe staging a run for president. And we'll see how that's looking. We'll also take a look at big layoffs at the ESPN and what that means for one of the big employers in our state. But let's start at the state capitol with the idea of not just the state budget, which needs to have a gigantic hole filled. Keith knows more about that than just about anybody else, but also about taxes and whether or not taxes are going to help fill that hole. Let's listen first to Kevin Sullivan. He's on Face the State. He's the commissioner of the Department of Revenue Services.
Connecticut already has the third most progressive income tax in the nation. Now, our overall tax system may not be because of property taxes, but for income taxes, the third most progressive income tax in the nation. That's just another way of saying that people at the high end pay a disproportionately strong share of that income tax, as they should, because that's where their incomes are. But it's not, the governor's been very clear about this when he started. He said, look, this is not a tax issue. We've done two tax raises. That obviously hasn't done it. It's got to be substantive. It's got to deal with spending. And then ultimately, it's got to deal with getting this economy going again.
And here's a big part of this, Keith and Paz, and I'll start with you. Whenever we hear about the possibility of new taxes at the state capitol, Keith, you've been saying this for years, it's probably unlikely that we're going to be able to fill this budget hole without some combination of taxes and other things. The problem is, once again, state tax revenues are in, I don't know, I guess the toilet or something below the toilet. State's 100 largest income taxpayers paid 45% less this year than last. The chickens or whatever are coming home to roost around us raising so much money around income taxes because we don't seem to ever be able to make the revenue projections from the taxes that we already have in place. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. There's a lot of spin going on here. And one of the biggest areas that I don't think is really proven right now is we've hit some sort of tipping point. I'm going to try to stick with your analogy here. We abused the rich chickens for too long, and now they're coming home. And
did you want the toilet in there somehow, too?
I was honestly weighing, do you go chickens or toilet? And I went with poultry.
Probably a good idea.
But here's the thing. If you just want to go statistically, one, this is not Armageddon as we've never seen before. Okay, I called up and I can when I get done making this point, I can tweet for people if they want to see it. If you look at how our capital gains and dividends related income tax receipts performed just before the 2009 recession, when surprise, surprise, they tanked by about 50% from the prior year, 2001, 1991, it's the same thing. The question is this happening because the rich have had enough? Or is it happening because, and it's funny that I'm describing a recession as the silver lining, actually we're just on the beginning of a downward slide into recession over the next 18 months. And if that happens, we're going to be probably losing at least another $500 million in income taxes.
Well,
doesn't mean this is some unprecedented. I mean, we know that after the last recession, the financial services sector contracted. We've seen the labor numbers for the last 6 years. But as far as all of a sudden, it's this mass exodus. That's all my favorite oxymoron, which is anecdotal evidence. Everybody knows the story of somebody leaving, but nobody's produced any hard data showing there's definitely a correlation between the exodus of the wealthy and this erosion.
Okay, so maybe it's not the exodus of the wealthy, Paz, but I think just from a political standpoint, it must be hard to be at the state capitol and propose raising new taxes when every single time we have an estimate of tax income, we never seem to hit that mark. We don't seem to be getting the revenue necessary from the taxes that we've imposed so far. Many economists will tell you that more taxes in a state like Connecticut may indeed slow the already slow economic growth. So that must be a pretty politically hard thing to sell at the state capitol.
Almost every prescription for what ails Connecticut, the downside is it was slow economic growth, which illustrates the problem that legislators have. There's no obvious place to go. The margins, as you know, are very tight in the House and the Senate. The Senate is tied. The House is almost tied. So the Democrats are barely clinging to control. There's really no appetite for raising taxes despite the need for revenue. House Speaker Joe Arasimowitz yesterday, you know, left the door open to that. But, you know, the question is that him signaling that, OK, I don't want to foreclose anything yet? But his House Majority Leader, you know, quickly said, well, I don't know that that's the path we want to go down. So Connecticut is, I can't stress how big a problem Connecticut is facing, both fiscally, which Keith can go into in, you know, chapter and verse, but politically. There's the path here. I mean, other fiscal crises, you can see the way out. You can see that it might be difficult. This time, I don't see the way out.
Colin?
All right. Yeah, I have more questions than answers or observations. But so, I mean, just so we're sketching this thing out and we kind of understand the positions people are staking out right now, the way that I understand it, that Malloy is still sort of saying, you know what, we can figure out a way to do this. Arasimowitz is saying, hey, maybe not without raising taxes, right? I mean, those are the respective positions as I understand them. One question that I have is, I mean, in a way, Connecticut, in the way that you've suggested, Keith, in a way, Connecticut sort of limps along and kind of rolls over these problems year after year. I mean, not only have we had these kinds of conversations at these kind of cliff-type intervals that you were describing, we kind of had this conversation almost every year. The comptroller announces, whoever the comptroller is, the tax revenues are much slower than they – I mean, maybe not as drastically slower as they are this time, but they're slower, they're smaller, things are not good, the budget's out of balance. The budget seems to be eternally out of balance. Ben Barnes was right. It is a permanent state of fiscal crisis. And so we kind of roll through these things and we have conversations about borrowing and tax increases and nibble around at the corners. And before you know it, it's next year. And I guess my question is, what would the real chickens really coming home to roost look like? I mean, you could sort of make the case based on the last 20 years of Connecticut history that you don't really have to exactly balance the budget, no matter what it says in the Constitution about spending caps or – like, they don't really do that, right?
No, they don't do that. But that's also why we had to borrow half $1 billion a couple of years ago to make payroll, because we played all these games for so long. We didn't have enough money in our checking account. That was what the whole gap debate that Governor Malloy brought up was about, which is our budget's been so fraudulent for so long. But just wanted to make one point about how real this is. I do think Paz is spot on when he says it's a very serious problem. The math just tells you it's a mess. And we've been talking, John, for a long time, I'm sorry, about how our problems on the spending side and our unfunded liabilities, our retirement benefits, what we owe there is what's driving up the budget. But we also know that every 6 or 8 years, whenever the economy slips, Connecticut particularly takes it on the chin because we rely upon a very volatile revenue stream and we don't save to smooth out those rough periods. I do want to also mention, though, because there's a lot of spin going on, Commissioner Sullivan talked this weekend about how really we should have seen this coming. But yet if you look on April 20th, 2 days after the income tax filing deadline, the administration was reporting no revenue erosion and a small surplus.
And I'm sorry, Keith, that was my point before. The point is that we continually hear that we don't have revenue erosion or that we're going to meet some sort of target. We make a goal, and then we say that this is the goal to hit, and then we never hit the goal. Right. It never, ever happens.
And Paz can speak to this better than I can, but the Governor Malloy's big challenge throughout his administration is managing expectations. His critics would say sometimes building the incorrect expectations. But nonpartisan analysts in January wanted to begin to downgrade the revenue forecasts, and the administration didn't want to do it when they did their last consensus report. Then the nonpartisan analyst basically in February said, we're going to start lowering them now. You may get in trouble, but we're not riding in that car with you. So they lowered them, and not by this amount, but they started to do that. And again, 2 days after the income tax filing deadline, and the administration's had access to numbers for quite a while before that, they still said, quoting Kevin Bacon in Animal House, stay calm, all is well, at least in writing. And I get that they don't want to necessarily come out until all the numbers are perfect, but you can't have it both ways and say, we saw this coming, but we didn't tell you, but we had good intentions when we didn't tell you, but trust me, you should have seen it coming.
Well, if nothing else, Paz, it seems as though if Governor Malloy's biggest problem has been managing expectations, then with almost no expectations left, with a dearth of expectations, he might be in a pretty good position here. There are no expectations. It seems as though we have no other choices.
He is politically free in that regard, and there is some value to that. But the question is, can he engage the Republicans? Because it's hard to see how you get a budget passed, particularly in the House, with just Democratic votes. But the Republicans, you know, with one eye on 2018 and the ability to fully take over control of state government, are understandably very wary about taking ownership of a budget that's destined to be colossally unpopular no matter which way you go.
I assume, is that the reason that they want to do this negotiations on television thing too?
That's the reason the Senate Democrats want to. I we think their feeling is people will see that the Republicans aren't playing. Now, the Republicans, particularly Senator Frisano, I think his attitude is, hey, fine, we have an alternative budget. You know, whether it works or not, people can debate. You know, we'll shove that in your face. But, you know, Governor Malloy and some of the others are looking at it saying, look, that's not a negotiation. That's reality TV. You know, Malloy talked about it as a, you know, a food fight.
Well, and for years, Colin, you've been trying to come up with reality TV shows to help buoy the fortunes of CTN, the Connecticut Network. I can't imagine a more boring reality TV show than negotiations at the state capitol live happening on television.
Right. I mean, I think all of us who are in this business, we tend to lean in favor of as much sunlight as possible and as much access to information as possible. You know, and the counter argument, typically, whether it's court proceedings or this, is that it creates a whole bunch of artificial behaviors. You know, people start playing to the cameras. I do. And now I'm imagining, like, they're really in a lot of trouble right now, and they're also in a hurry, and they've got a time crunch. But if they're going to do this, you know, I wonder if they're going to get sort of do like mock budget negotiations where they have surrogates playing Len Fasano.
Don't underestimate that budget niche audience and the ratings you could get from that, please.
This is very big in Keith Banner's household. Go ahead.
But, I mean, can you imagine like a conversation on TV where Malloy says to Fasano, all right, name two members of your caucus we might possibly get to vote for the budget, or to Themis Claridis. It will never happen. It's impossible. Right. That's why it's a dumb idea.
It's like the budget negotiation would have to happen someplace else.
Right.
I mean, the thing that you're describing, which is very much how this goes, all that stuff couldn't happen in front of the cameras.
I've already bought the DVDs with commentary. I've already ordered it.
No, you are the commentary, Keith.
It's on pre-order.
Let's be clear about that.
Let's quickly go to Mike, who's calling from Windsor. Hey there, Mike. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just heard on your radio station that Governor Malloy is in labor negotiations with the state unions. Can you guys, all of you guys, explain what that means, okay? And does the public get to see the outcomes of negotiated? And do we get to see the contracts? Or does the press get to see the contracts? And if not, how come?
Great questions, Mike. I'll ask Keith Faniff about that. I will say that if the press got to see the contracts, I'm pretty sure you'd get to see the contracts as well. But anyway,
sure. Keith. As far as all the details, Even the nonpartisan analysts the last time around didn't get to see all the details. They were effectively told, you'll get what we give you, and that's about it. And they came out and had to tell the legislature, we can't confirm about 70% of what the administration is claiming. I don't think that was Governor Malloy in his first year. I don't think he gets that much of a pass. If he strikes a deal with the unions, and the talks have been going on since about November, they haven't borne fruit yet. The governor's looking for these talks to solve about a third of the problem now that we're facing.
Is that realistic, a third of the problem?
I don't think it's realistic because in modern history, we've never achieved something. Even if we adjust, now he's looking for something worth about an average of about $700 to $800 million a year for the next years. Even if you adjust for inflation, Governor Malloy, Governor Rell, Governor Rowland, Governor Weicker never got that.
Mm. I just want to play quickly a cut from Governor Malloy from Where We Live on Monday, talking about taxes, especially in the top 1%.
We, for a very long period of time, and I've asked the legislature not to do this, have been putting our eggs in one basket, and that is that the top 1% would pay 30 or 35 or more percent of our actual revenue. They wake up to that at some point, and they react, and then there are reasons to react even further, such as President Trump's election and his promise of tax reform in 2017 could be an indication why some people might divert profits that they might have recognized in 16 into 17. That may be part of it. We don't know. People deciding to live in other jurisdictions. Quite frankly, it was a tougher year than I think a lot of people thought in the hedge fund industry as well. So, you know, there are a number of reasons, but we are probably the most dependent state on highest income earners out there. And that makes these swings, which are relatively slight, if we had a broader tax base, extreme in a place like Connecticut.
Colin, I just thought that was interesting in part because I guess I'd never heard anybody at the state capitol talk about the possibility and the impact of President Trump's promise of tax reform, whether or not that promise ever comes to fruition. Is there any way in which the specter of Donald Trump and what he might do to the tax code actually changes the behavior of high-income earners in Connecticut?
Wow, that's a question that's probably above my expertise level / pay grade. I mean, one of the nice things about federal tax reform, of course, is it affects everybody the same way. But in terms of how it drives behavior, I think you kind of need an economist as opposed to me. Do you have it?
Well, yeah. I mean, we saw this before when the Bush tax cuts were expiring. It affected when people were going to take profits. So yeah. I think that's what the governor was talking about, that are people delaying taking profits now and therefore they don't have to pay taxes? I mean, their stock portfolios can get more valuable, but your taxes don't go up until you sell the stuff. So that's what the governor was talking about. Will people wait till next year in the hope that Trump is going to get through some advantageous tax changes to investment income?
Mm. Right, because, I mean, that's sort of intuitively the announcement from the budget office and from Lembo is a little bit of a surprise in the sense that at the investment level, the market seems to be performing pretty well. So, like, how come there's no money? And it's because of what he's saying. There's no money until you actually cash something in, until you actually take profits. I just want to go back to Mike's question because I'm not sure we answered it all the way.
Yeah.
And one reason we didn't answer it all the way is that I don't know the answer to it. Yeah. And so, one thing I was going to ask you is, what is on the table? So let's say you're looking for $500 million or something. What's things like tier one pensions and stuff, that's all off the table. What is there to talk about?
So the things they can talk about that would have an immediate impact is greater employee contributions to their pension. You know, the biggest problem Connecticut's facing on pensions, it's unfunded liability. It's debt for people who are already retired. For the current state employees, the retirement system is fairly stable. You know, they're making their actuarial payments, by and large. Connecticut's employee contributions do tend to be low, you know, compared to other states nationally. So that's a natural area. Now, the governor and the unions have not divulged what the ask is, but the negotiations are with CBAC, this coalition of state bargaining agents, and their charge is retirement and health. They're not the ones that negotiate the individual pay raises with the individual unions. Those are also going on at the same time. So there are multiple sets of talks, one with CBAC on concessions that could be on health benefits and retirement benefits. And then you have individual bargaining units, and presumably the state is saying zero raises for the foreseeable future.
Okay, so Keith, we crunch all those numbers, yeah. And where do we get?
I can kind of give you the lightning round version here. Start with the whole. It's about $2.5 billion, 12%, which, by the way, is about two-thirds of the mess that Governor Malloy inherited. That's how big it's gotten. He was looking at about an 18% gap if we don't adjust our finances. If we got a pay freeze and some changes on pension contributions like Paz talked about and some co-pays, you would be very lucky to get to $400 or $500 million, or about one-fifth of the problem. To me, what's interesting is not just the governor's ask, but the union's counter-ask, because I think they're going to have – and they've been saying we're going to have a very hard time if all we're telling the employees that in exchange for this, there are no layoffs. Because the governor called us all into his office 13 months ago and said he was going to have 2,000 state employees laid off by the end of June. It's 13 months later and he still hasn't hit 1,100. The threat of layoffs is getting to be like the most idle threat since my parents said they were going to drive us back from the parking lot at Sanders Village when I was four. If my sister and I didn't stop fighting, we knew we weren't heading back to Connecticut no matter what. And they know that you just can't hit layoffs that deeply for a whole host of problems. So the unions are saying if we're going to really sell this, you have to extend the benefits program, the one that we're already not saving for, and offer it. Now we have to offer it to everybody hired through 2022. They're probably going to want five more years to get it to 2027 so that you get it through two more terms and you could have 8 years of a Republican governor and the program is still safe.
Colin, you have just 30 seconds for a response and you have to work Santa's Village into it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I thought I was Santa's Village back in 2009 with that round of concessions. I don't know what to say about that other than I sort of wonder, I go back to what Paz said about Governor Malloy being a little bit more politically free than he has in the past. I mean, there are probably real actual structural reasons why he's at 1,100 layoffs as opposed to 2,000. But if there are any political reasons, if there's any, reason he didn't do that because he didn't think, it would play with certain constituencies, he may be less worried about that right now. But I think the larger point you're making is the important one, which is this is all nibbling. There is no way to solve this problem with one big bite. And some of the kinds of nibbling that they could have done, they didn't do. Like, I don't know, we don't have time to talk about this, but you can't do tolls now and get the money for, 2 years or something like that?
Or five.
Five or something. But, maybe seeing the problem coming down the road would have been a good idea.
Seeing the problem coming down the road. There's a last good metaphor for us. Colin McEnroe hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Keith Faniff is the budget guru at the Connecticut Mirror. Mark Pazniokas is the Capitol Bureau Chief at that same Connecticut Mirror. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Chris Murphy, who's been very, very vocal about Donald Trump, even agreeing with Trump on some things, and maybe raising some money to go run for president. You can join us here on The Wheelhouse right after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news today with Keith Faniff from the Connecticut Mirror. Mark Pazniokas, also from the Connecticut Mirror. You can read them at ctmirror.org. And our own Colin McEnroe is here as well. What is on the Colin McEnroe Show today, Colin?
Well, I guess it doesn't really connect to anything we're talking about, except that it's something else you could be worried about. And we decided to take a small question. Is there an afterlife? And so we're actually going to be looking at what science even has to say about whether there's an afterlife. It'll also be one of the shows that we do in American Sign Language on Facebook Live on the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page. If I can have 20 more seconds, I want to promote one more thing, which is one of our producers here, Jonathan McNichol, has been doing this very interesting podcast called The Second First Season about the Yard Goats. And I was telling Paz before we went on the air, the second episode is so great because it's really kind of about it's about how grounds are tended and stuff like that. But he found so many people who are still alive who have some connection to the history of Hartford baseball, including Gene Conley, who famously pitched for the Hartford Chiefs and pitched in the major leagues and played in the NBA at the same time. I think he's one of the few people to win a World Series and win an NBA championship.
And win an NBA championship as well.
And he found him. for an interview.
And it's a wonderful podcast. You can find it wherever podcasts are found, and it really does go back into the history, including the old Hartford baseball yard that is now just a field in the middle of the city. So
this
Jonathan
used to be my playground.
Jonathan McNichol's new podcast, the second first season. Let's turn to national politics and turn to Chris Murphy, someone who we've known for a long time as he's a very ambitious politician, and he's a politician that seems to have found his stride in this new Trump administration. Here's Chris Murphy on Rachel Maddow talking about Trump's decision to meet with a variety of despotic world leaders.
This walk back from our historical leadership position on human rights is pretty stunning. It runs the gamut from these complimentary comments about President Duterte, who reports say has potentially endorsed the killing of 9,000 civilians without trial, to his support for the president of Egypt, who has jailed maybe 40,000 political opponents. All of this makes us sort of shrink as a nation from a position of moral leadership, but it also, you know, ultimately endangers us because as we are seen as complicit in these killings, as we are seen backing up brutal dictators in Muslim countries, the folks that are organizing against us, they use this to try to recruit, and that puts us ultimately at risk.
Murphy backed up his appearance on Maddow with a tweet. We are watching in real time as the American human rights bully pulpit disintegrated into ash. Is Chris Murphy leading the charge in Congress right now against Donald Trump? It seems as though he's able to play Colin some of the same games on Twitter and able to use language in a way that I think probably gets under Trump's skin a little bit. What are you seeing, Chris Murphy, right now?
Well, I think Trump or Trump's people think so. Murphy was on a list of, I think, four Democrats that Steve Bannon wanted to have researched as potential opponents. I think for all of us sitting here, it's always a struggle to see somebody the way that you know and that you've known since. I mean, we all knew Chris since he was a state senator from Cheshire or wherever he is. Cheshire, is that where he's from?
Yes.
You know, I mean, we all knew him that, you know, and then we watched him be a congressman and, you know, we watched him ascend to the Senate. And in some ways, he's still like this guy that we feel like we know who he is and what his liabilities are. And he's a very human figure to all of us. But, you know, I think on the national stage, he plays pretty well. And yes, if in fact, I think that you put it perfectly. I mean, if this is the way politics is being conducted these days, he's better at that kind of bare knuckle stuff than an awful lot of other people. So he's being listed by most political pundits as kind of a second tier 2020 presidential candidate. Although whenever I see those lists, the first tier, everybody's like 117. It's like Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. So I don't think Murphy's second tier. I think he's going to run for president and he'll be an interesting part of that field.
Pass?
I think Colin's absolutely right that the last people to ask about somebody's prospects for president are the reporters who have covered him for a long time. there's a great history there. I mean, Chris Murphy has speed dated his way through Connecticut politics. He has gone from the State House of Representatives very quickly to the State Senate. He took on a sitting congresswoman in the 5th District, Nancy Johnson, which looked like it was going to be a two-cycle fight, you know, weaken her the first time, but he ended up winning. And then he quickly went on to the U.S. Senate. So his history says he does not lack for ambition. He does not lack for boldness. I mean, I remember Chris Healy, the former Republican chairman, one of the few times he expressed some admiration for Chris Murphy. And Chris, Healy, if you're listening right now, don't throw anything at your radio. I'll quickly close the loop. He does not admire Chris Murphy's politics, but his boldness, the fact that he would do what many members of the General Assembly are reluctant to do, which is to roll the dice on losing their office and moving up. So that has been a constant in his life. He now needs to sort of build the resume in the U.S. Senate that shows he might be taken seriously. And he has been taking those steps as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He has been going on overseas trips with people like John McCain. He has been building some relationships across the aisle, you know, all the things that make you seen seriously as a United States senator.
And not just the overseas trips that so many people in Washington have made over the course of the last 15 or so years around the many wars that we're fighting to the Middle East. You know, you put on a flak jacket, you walk around for a little bit, and you see how the troops are doing. He's become somewhat of an expert on Ukraine and Eastern Europe and trying to actually talk and learn about the geopolitics in a part of the world that we weren't thinking about too terribly long ago and now are more vitally important to us on the world stage.
Absolutely. While keeping an eye on home state politics, you know, his Buy American proposal, he has been kind of, you know, cavilling about the Pentagon ignoring a law that goes back to the early 20th century about a requirement to buy American unless you cannot find certain supplies. And Murphy has made the case quite compellingly that the Pentagon routinely ignores this, and he can point to manufacturers in Connecticut that would benefit greatly. And as a political issue, this gives him some grounds to be reasonable with President Trump, to reach out to President Trump, which he has, and say, rather than just talking, you know, about blowing up trade deals, here you have a law that's been on the books for the better part of a century. How about we enforce this and bring some business to American manufacturers?
Yeah, he praised Trump, if only slightly, around the Buy American plan. This is from The Current. Murphy's urged Trump to appoint a Buy American government watchdog, audit government purchases to ensure Buy American compliance, require a jobs impact assessment to account for U.S. job creation when awarding government contracts, crack down on excessive waivers of Buy American efforts, and establish a centralized government website to increase transparency. Probably some things in there, that President Trump would like, and some things he doesn't, but at least he's able to find some common ground. What are you seeing, Chris Murphy, Keith?
Well, I don't have anywhere close to Paz's background on this, but I would think if Chris Murphy has any aspirations, they probably don't want to lead him back to run for governor, because I don't know if anybody really wants to clean up the mess that's waiting for him here.
That is one thing that people have talked about, right? That you maybe come back and you run for governor and you show that you can run a state, you can be a CEO of a big organization, because that's the one thing that most senators lack.
Well, you can do that, but I Paz and I go back and forth on this all the time. There's only so much you can do with political messaging, and the numbers are just you just can't trump the math, and no bad pun intended there. At some point, things get really bad, and I think all you can do is try to find some way to say I'm mitigating a downward spiral. And I just don't. I'm sorry, I'm kind of shifting the gears here a little bit. I don't see a lot of people when they start looking at running for governor saying, is that really the message I want to deliver?
You see how deftly he did that? He took it right back to the budget, right back to governor.
Let's not get down in the—
Give me five more minutes and we're in the parking lot at Santa's Village in New Hampshire. I can take you there.
One thing that I would just sort of suggest to people watch. I mean, so the Democrats, as we know, I mean, nationally, they have a big problem, which is that they are effectively two parties, the party of Hillary Clinton and the party of Bernie Sanders. And if they don't get back to being one party, they're going to have a lot of problems. They're going to have a problem in the 2018 cycle, and they're going to have a problem in 2020, too. And so people who are trying to position themselves on the national stage right now for a possible 2020 presidential run, you know, in a way, they have to figure out, how do you craft a message so that you don't alienate either one of those groups? And, you know, I don't know that nationally the Bernie Sanders wing of the party looks at Chris Murphy and goes, that's our guy. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that they look at him and say, oh, no way, you know, because I don't think he comes across as the kind of boilerplate establishment DLC kind of Democrat that Clinton came across as. But ultimately, one of the things he's going to have to do is figure out, because they all have to figure out how to do this, is how to talk to both of those groups and persuade both of those groups to make common cause and be the same party.
Yeah, and that's really a question. It's a great point by Colin. It's a question, Paz, about what part of the party Chris Murphy currently occupies. Is he on the Hillary Clinton wing, but maybe a younger wing that's able to make an argument around progressive ideals better than some of the establishment? Or is he sort of part of a shinier, slicker wing of the Bernie Sanders party and maybe a little bit more palatable than Elizabeth Warren would be to a large number of Americans?
And remember, you're not under oath.
Well, Donald Trump has helped, right? But they have to get past, okay, the unifying Donald Trump unifies the Democrats only to a degree. And then you get to the problem that Colin laid out. And I don't know. I don't know in his heart of hearts how Chris Murphy would define himself. I tend to believe you would see him more as an establishment liberal Democrat who has been involved in government and politics since really leaving law school. This has been his life. So, you know, he does not have experience far afield from politics. Along with every other member of the Democratic establishment in Connecticut, you know, the superdelegates, he was a superdelegate who committed early to Hillary Clinton. He was not with Bernie Sanders. He did avoid, I think, annoying Sanders the way Governor Malloy did when Governor Malloy was a surrogate at times. But again, that sort of dodges the basic question that Colin posed.
Well, I'll put the happiest face on this or the nicest face on it. I think one advantage that Murphy has is that he's not ideologically rooted in one camp or another, that, you know, his positions, and John, I think you were doing a good job of talking about some of his newly developed expertise, but his positions kind of go situation by situation, right?
Fair.
He's pretty radical on gun control because of Sandy Hook and some other stuff, you know, and maybe a little bit closer to the center and some other stuff. And you know, that could be read as a guy, well, let's put the happy face on it. That allows him to move around, I think, pretty effectively. I mean, he can persuasively position himself as kind of a progressive on certain things without necessarily scaring the DLC people. And that may be a big advantage down the road.
And Sandy Hook, you know, I don't want to look at everything as just cold political calculation.
Right.
Chris Murphy and John McKinney were both standing in the doorway at the firehouse in Sandy Hook when Governor Malloy notified those parents that they weren't going to be seeing their children again. And I think that did make a profound impression on him. So that has helped fuel this. I think it's been good politics as far as his place in the Democratic Party, but I think there is something genuine there.
Yeah, and there's a genuine outrage that comes from it as Trump took the stage to champion the Second Amendment at a National Rifle Association convention last week. The senator countered his message by unleashing a Twitter storm using the names, ages, and pictures of gun violence victims. This has all played very well, and it's helped Murphy to raise a lot of money. He wrote in an email to supporters, we read this in The Current, that he'd raised at least $2 million so far this year, more than 55,000 individual contributions. So it seems, as we've said before, that Trump is helping. Before we leave this segment, I just want to turn back to Keith. You know, we've mentioned a lot of people, Keith, who have been saying that they are going to run for governor. In the last week, we had one person whose work you know very well, jump in fully into this race. It's Kevin Lembo, the state comptroller. I guess I'm wondering, as someone who follows the budget probably about as closely as Kevin Lembo does, he has some interesting ideas about where to take the state. He certainly has been at odds with Governor Malloy about the prescription we might have to get out of this. Is Kevin Lembo a viable candidate for governor now that he's fully in?
Well, I think Kevin Lembo has to make a very difficult decision because Kevin really does understand to a certain extent how much of the fiscal die is cast. And the question is, how much of that is a winning campaign message? How much can you – I don't think, you know, anybody can come out there and say, the best I can promise you over the next 4 or 8 years is that I'm going to mitigate a downward painful spiral. And if you – think
great
that message
sticker
does sell, you can go to, you know,
mitigate the spiral.
You can
Lembo.
You can go to, you know, Keith Fanna for governor at notachanceinheck.com. But I just think Kevin is already kind of starting to pull back on that. I've seen things where he's saying, like, you know, things have to change, and you start talking in as many generalities as possible.
Things do have to change.
But that, I mean, I go back to the Malloy Foley campaigns, and the degree of spin was what always stuck out to me. I think it's like inversely proportional to the scope of the problem. The bigger the deficit, the bigger the promises, and ultimately the bigger the voter disillusionment.
There's no way politicians can be honest when they're facing huge deficits and hope to be elected. And that's the dilemma that Malloy and Foley had in 2014. That'll be the dilemma that Kevin Lembo will face this time.
I mean, gubernatorial campaigns aren't quite as granular with voters as we maybe make them. Ultimately, Lembo has to persuade people that he has the competence and the independence to do the best that anybody can do with a bunch of intractable budget problems, and that he's trustworthy and a good leader in other ways. And I actually think, you know, he's got a good chance of doing all those things.
We'll turn next when we come back from our break to something that hasn't been really good news for the state, the announcement of a lot of layoffs at ESPN, one of our flagship companies here in the state. Find out what that means maybe for the future of the company based in Bristol. We're talking with Colin McEnroe of the Colin McEnroe Show, Mark Pazniokas of the Connecticut Mirror, Keith Vanoff also of the Connecticut Mirror. That's right after this in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking, as always, with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror at ctmirror.org. Also from the Connecticut Mirror, Keith Vanoff, our budget guru. We want to turn to news that we heard last week, Colin, that took a lot of us maybe by surprise, just maybe in the scope of it. ESPN has had a series of layoffs over the course of the last couple of years. Their fortunes are down in part because of cable cutters like myself who have turned away from the traditional way in which they consume sports on television. Among the 100 layoffs are our buddy Doug Glanville, a Hartford resident who's been actively involved in the community and was a Major League Baseball analyst. But we also heard of some well-known on-air personalities, other people who are reporters, writers for college sports. As I looked at the list of layoffs, Colin, I couldn't quite see a thread there. Is ESPN getting out of one business or into another business? I just know that it looks like kind of bad business for a big state company that the state has invested an awful lot in, and this feels like a really big blow to them.
Well, I mean, let's start with the baseline economics, and it does sort of depend on who you talk to. If you talk to people at ESPN, they're going to say, well, we're just not making money as fast, as hand over fist as we used to. But the reality is they've got some real problems. They've lost 12 million subscribers since 2011. I mean, on a chart, that looks really scary. They had one month where they lost 620,000 subscribers. It's not all cord cutters. It's also ways in which the bundles have shifted around a little bit so that, you know, it's a little bit easier maybe to get a cable bundle that doesn't have ESPN in it. It used to be really difficult to do it. It's always the most expensive thing in the bundle. As we know. The other problem they have is that rights are just being jacked up through the roof. I mean, their big expense is acquisition of rights. Max Chafkin from Bloomberg said on Weekend, All Things Considered, this one just blew my mind. He said, one game of Monday Night Football cost a year's budget of Game of Thrones. And one might ask, how did rights get so expensive? And is ESPN in any way responsible for the jacking up of rights costs? One might think that maybe they are, as they were outbidding competitors for all that kind of stuff. But they've got a problem now. And, you know, there's even a theory that it's depressing Disney's stock price a little bit. Disney's stock price has gone down despite having Star Wars. So there's kind of a problem somewhere that they'd like to figure out. So, yeah, I mean, you know, this is all, you know, in 2011, they seemed like one of the really impregnable media franchises and brand names in America. And in 2017, it just looks really different.
But we talk about rights fees being so high. Does this mean ESPN has to back out of some of the live sports coverage over time, get into more of the talking heads? It's a lot cheaper. You know, a lot of people arguing about sports is not people either reporting on sports out in the field or people covering games, which is a lot of money.
Yeah, if I knew the answer to that, my name would be John Skipper. But my guess is that they can't completely, you know, divorce themselves from actually delivering games. That's sort of where you get some of your credibility. Now, I don't know. I was actually in touch with Doug Glanville this week. I love Doug Glanville. He's great. So I guess what they're doing, and maybe, Paz, you know something about this, that they're somehow or other combining what they were doing with live baseball on television with MLB's own package, right? They're doing that somehow, and I don't. Maybe even it hasn't been spelled out all that way.
I don't know precisely how it's happening, but I mean they're facing the same disruption that the business in general has faced. But it affects the sports economy. ESPN has bid up the rights on all these things. If ESPN after this round of contracts is, you know, it goes by the wayside, if they pull back, you know, this is going to ripple throughout professional sports. That the you know, unless Fox Sports decides we don't care, we're backed by, you know, Fox News and the rest, and we're going to pour money into it because all it takes is one bidder to make it go up. But I think it's going to be an unsettled period in professional sports broadcasting for quite a while.
Yeah, two things. Going back to Mr. Skipper's point, I do want to point out that, like, I also agree. Don't feel too sorry for Disney. They have Star Wars. They have Marvel Entertainment. But all kidding aside, and I think Tucker Ives could back me up on this being a huge baseball geek. MLB and the MLB Network, MLB.com, they're more and more of their programming. They're actually moving online. People can stream, and they're providing a lot of stuff free to lure people in. ESPN is definitely behind the curve, at least in the realm of baseball.
But I think that that's important, Keith. Is in some ways, ESPN holding on to this cable bundling world in which so much money was going to ESPN from every single cable bundle that you had to have. Now, as things break apart and you can watch MLB games in different ways, and as other networks have gotten into this direct delivery service, ESPN, for all its brilliance over the years, seems to be so far behind on that.
I think that is the case. There's so many places where ESPN was and probably still is cutting edge, but and there's a definite niche here that I think they're far from the lead.
And I mean, so demographically, that's really a problem too, because what's happening, you know, happens to every sector of the media is one audience begins to die off and is replaced by another audience. Very specifically, what's happening this time is that the new audience is a bunch of young people who have never had cable bills in their lives. They've never paid cable bills, and they're not about to start because they live in a world where people get their stuff, Keith, in the way that you're saying. So what ESPN did, it is sort of the classic business mistake, right? They defended their old paradigm, which was the bundle, you know? Mm-hmm. They defended the bundle with their dying breath, you know, while, in fact, the bundle was becoming less and less relevant, particularly to this new group of people. You got to serve this new group of people. And, yeah, their online presence— you probably have a better sense of this than anybody. You're a sports fan and you're a cord cutter, and you probably think they suck.
And I don't watch as much live sports as I used to. I'm always amazed whenever I go to any network that is showing a game on my iPad, and they don't have anywhere near the commercial time sold for that digital service as they would online. It doesn't make any sense. And I don't know, Paz, to Colin's point, those kids who've never paid a cable bill, they're thinking, why on earth would I pay any money for Home Shopping Network, which I never watch? I only pay for the things I watch, and I'll pay a premium for the things I care about.
No, you're right. And it's not just ESPN. I mean, this comes as the NFL, for the first time, is getting really nervous. They've had a downturn in their ratings. And, you know, some commentators say, well, it could be American society's concern about concussions. I don't think so. I think it's more basic than that. I think it might be generational, and I think, you know, you guys have touched on it. You have younger people who have never had cable. They may follow the NFL, but not in the way that an older generation did. So these are the things that everybody's trying to figure out now. How big is the generational and structural change that's facing sports broadcasting?
I would be remiss if I didn't bring up one last thing that kind of is tied to the state budget with Keith Fanifer on this. You know, ESPN was given some very sweetheart deals by the state. A lot of people said when the state invested in ESPN, was it one of the first five, the first 10, the first 15?
Well, I honestly don't remember. I do know that it goes back, though, even earlier than that. I mean, assistance to ESPN, you can date back earlier than the Roland administration, and it's come in several
NBC
bunches.
NBC Sports was a first five.
NBC Sports was first five, but I guess my point is that many people thought ESPN was going to expand in Bristol, Connecticut anyway. They were going to build a digital hub without any state support. Now we start to see more and more layoffs, the threat of even more layoffs. Is anybody at the state who's invested in ESPN worried about what's happening here?
I think the bigger fear is that because we're all in with ESPN and we don't have enough poker chips, so we can't afford to gamble, we'll have to stay with ESPN. And I think if they come to the state, you will see a lot of people say, well, we don't have any other choice but to double down.
They could probably make this thing work. I mean, I think they have 90 million households still paying those cable fees. That's a lot of cable fees. And of course, the great thing about the ESPN model is you get that fee from the bundle and then you sell ads. So you sort of get people twice. And I don't know if the tweak that they just did was the right tweak, but there probably is a tweak.
Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, thank you so much. Also, thanks to Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Keith Faniff from the Connecticut Mirror as well. You can read them both at ctmirror.org. Thanks to Colin Wolf, our technical producer, Katie Tolarski, our executive producer, here in the Wheelhouse on WNPR.